One of the most talked about names in Chicago gay nightclub history is the Bearded Lady, the alter ego of performance artist Robert Thighs. BL, as her friends called her, would whip her audience into a frenzy with an interactive striptease that often involved the removal of dozens of costumes. The audience laughter and applause wouldn't end until the DJ drowned them out with hot disco music.
The Bearded Lady's life was legendary, because it's hard to document nightlife when those who witnessed it are dead or were too drunk to remember anything. Today, historian Owen Keenan joins us to chat about his new book, Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady, which looks at the life of the bearded lady who ruled the roost at Dugan's Bistro, a Chicago disco that pioneered the use of spectacle in nightclubs, later adopted by clubs like the famous Studio 54.
Listen as we talk about the kind of wild shenanigans happening in Chicago just years after the Stonewall riots.
Why queer culture has always been multicultural.
And that one appearance the bearded lady had on Oprah. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. We love talking to artists who have an amazing story to tell. 10 years ago, the little black girl from the Brewster Projects, who grew up to be a supermodel, came on our podcast to talk about her new TV show, RuPaul's Drag Race. We knew Ru had a hit show on her hands, but Ru had doubts. From your mouth to God's ears, Ru said, and just like her song, soon, Ru's TV career finally took off. You better work, RuPaul!
Now in our 15th season, we've interviewed so many incredible artists from around the world and RuPaul's Drag Race. From the winners to the first eliminated, many amazing artists' first interviews were right here on Feast of Fun. We built this city on rock and roll and a lot of makeup, wigs, charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
We were able to do that because we had support from you. Right now, the very computer that recorded all those podcasts said, I had it officially. The cost of repairing the computer is so high, it's better to replace it.
Amazingly, you have stepped up and gotten us so close to our goal. If we're able to go over the amount, we'll be able to repair our fourth microphone, replace our hard drive and cables to get the show sounding better than ever.
We count on your support, so thank you. Please take a moment and share or give any amount to save the Feast of Fun computer. Visit GoFundMe.com/Feast of Fun Computer or visit the link on our website, feastoffun.com. Our guest today is historian Owen Keenan, whose new book, Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady, takes a look at Chicago's wild gay nightclub scene in the 70s and 80s through the life of the bearded beauty. The Bearded Lady was one of Chicago's big gay media personalities in the 70s, but she quit her entertainment ways, moved to Tokyo, and then after her retirement, managed to sneak herself onto the Oprah Winfrey show and got all the people in Chicago being like, the Bearded Lady is back. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Owen.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
So paint us a picture of how people in Chicago reacted to seeing this legend, this nightclub personality that they had grown up with. They'd seen it at all the clubs. She had retired. She was done with her career. And she snuck herself onto the Oprah Winfrey audience.
By then, BL, the Bearded Lady, had been a nightclub personality for so long that the show was about celebutantes, which were sort of the 80s version of club kids, people who were famous for going out to clubs and being outrageous.
Yeah. Mm.
But these were all based in New York. The thing that I liked most about the Bearded Lady's appearance on Oprah is, one, the fact that BL went there with earrings, dress, hat with a veil, the whole bit, but also Oprah's expression when BL is eventually asked a question. And her question at that point, BL asks the celebutantes on stage, what do you do when you go home after the club closes? What sort of life do you have outside of that? And for me, it was really sort of moving to watch that, because by then, BL was 38 years old, had done Dugan's Bistro since 1973, become a celebrity, and just basked in the limelight of nightlife for that long before moving to Tokyo. So I think that appearance for me makes, it's almost like a sweet thing to say. Mm. Like, I wish someone would...
It was her swan song?
Well, BL would periodically perform at parties and things like that in Tokyo, but the venues in Tokyo were a lot smaller at the time. So you're going from a city that would have larger clubs to a place that would seat maybe 20 people.
Mm-hmm. I remember that moment, and certainly it felt like a coup. Anytime that as LGBT people, we did not see ourselves on television, especially those daytime talk shows, Donahue dressing up in drag and, you know, Geraldo Rivera having like transgender sex workers on the show.
Club kids,
Sally Jesse Raphael, all these really phenomenal people that we knew that we would never see ourselves on television, to having them on television was really thrilling excitement.
Well, the thing that I love about that episode is the fact that the club kids are all on stage. BL gets up and asks the question with absolutely no, like, it is, it doesn't even make a ripple that BL's standing there in drag, mm-hmm, asking a question of these club kids.
And how'd they respond? Because she asked, what's your life like when you're not doing
this? It kind of was glossed over. It didn't really, mm-hmm, you know. I think a lot of them were young, and maybe, mm-hmm, they just didn't.
Do you think that she asked that question because, you know, she'd pretty much retired her career, you know, from performing here in Chicago, and just kind of wanted to know, like, how do you keep it going or whatever, or like, I have something else in my life now?
I think it was a very reflective question to ask. I almost think it was sort of maybe BL saying to those club kids that were on stage, you know, I was where you were at one time. I was fortunate enough to have other things going in my life, but if you don't have anything else, it's kind of a hollow existence eventually.
Let's go back in time.
Okay. Please go back in time.
Disco Inferno.
Nightclubs were, gay nightclubs were the rage after the Stonewall riots. New York, San Francisco, and Chicago were the places for gay people to move to get together. Mm. There was no internet. And they were having a blast at these nightclubs.
Do you know, one of the most gratifying things about doing this book was people would talk about the River North area, which was where a lot of the nightclubs were at the time. The Bistro was there, the Baton, the Gold Coast, Sundays, PQs. There were a lot of nightclubs there.
So it was the gayborhood.
The gayborhood.
But people didn't live there, but they just went to party there.
People didn't live there, but from Friday afternoon when everybody left from work till Monday morning, it was just an LGBTQ free-for-all. Mm. And it was so affirming to hear all these older people talk about what it felt like coming from being so repressed to suddenly coming out and seeing all this, these gay people. Mm. I heard repeatedly, I didn't know there were that many gay people in the world.
Well, when we think about gay communities, we think of them as, especially in this day and age, as a very physical, you know, permanent structure. In Chicago, we think of that. In New York City, we think of the, you know, Greenwich Village, Christopher Street.
You know, you have the Castro in San Francisco, and, you know, Chicago. Now we have Boys Town, but now, like, most gay people live in Edgewater and Andersonville. Mm-hmm. And we have, like, our cemented gay village. But back then, it was a very transient neighborhood, and Chicago also was a transient. You had all these people from the Midwest coming here and living here at a time, you know, after Stonewall and that liberation and that huge population, because those baby boomers, you know, they were a lot of people. So there's a lot of young, horny, gay men hopping on Rivers North.
You know what a lot of it was, too, is people had been repressed for so long that all of a sudden there was freedom. People just wanted to go to bars, party, have fun. It was the pre-AIDS era, so there really wasn't anything to worry about that, you know, a shot of penicillin couldn't cure. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just out to have fun. And for that decade It was an amazing period. The Bistro was there from 73 to 82. So the Bistro was sort of ground zero for a lot of the
shenanigans.
I'm trying to think of a good word for it. Revelry.
Gay culture is always nomadic. Yeah. You know, yes. We're always moving from our homes to someplace else. And then when we move to those neighborhoods always evolve and change. And with any nomadic culture, you need shamans. And now we have the perfect storm, so to speak, of culture, of critical mass to allow somebody like the Bearded Lady to exist.
Well, the Bearded Lady actually first comes into this. Well, we learn about the Bearded Lady's background, but there was a disco down there called PQ's. And what happened was...
This is in Chicago.
This is in Chicago. This is probably 71. And BL shows up at the bar in fishnets and a tartan kilt. And what happens is the people who eventually... Eddie Dugan, who eventually opens the Bistro, they remember how outrageous the Bearded Lady was. And one of Eddie's primary motivators for opening the disco and for keeping it going was to have things going on there that people would talk about. And right from the beginning, he knew that the Bearded Lady would be the sort of personality of this new kind of nightclub that people would talk about on Monday morning.
Because that's the way to get the word, you know, the word out to people was just word of mouth. We didn't have the social media. So if something outrageous happened, you'd be like, oh, my God, you should have seen what happened at the club.
And he was a master at that. Yeah. Eddie Dugan was a master at being outrageous and just showing people a better time than they ever imagined they could have.
What were sort of the events and experiences they had there?
Oh, my gosh. It was his goal to make it be an event every single night. So there would be times when people would come in and the bar might be redone as the inside of a cave. And they'd spent like all week sort of, you know, making stalactites and stalagmites. They had wild animals there one night. Another night, for his birthday, Eddie was lowered from a hole in the ceiling into a bathtub in the middle of the dance floor, and then scantily clad, basically go-go boys, came forward and filled the bathtub with champagne.
Wild animals? Did anybody get hurt?
No. But one of my favorite stories is they're talking about dropping off the wild animals for I think this was one of Eddie's birthday parties as well. And they get to the bar and they find out that the lion cage is too wide to get through the front door.
The lion cage.
So rather
they had
than
a lion in a nightclub.
Yes.
So with rather drunk than people and so, drugs.
So rather than
what could go wrong?
So rather than just saying, you know, this isn't going to work, we'll take everything else, Eddie says, you know, we should just take the cage apart. Let the lion out, take the cage apart, and then bring it in, and then we can just reassemble it inside. So my favorite description in the book is when they talk about rounding up the lion to get him back in the cage. It's so many outrageous, incredible things.
Did they have an animal handler for this?
The guy who brought the cages, but I don't know the details of it specifically. But
typically, when you rent wild animals, somebody that is there to monitor the situation.
He's like low minimum wage.
But that lion spent the whole night in a discotheque, in a cage,
yes,
in a
yes.
discotheque.
Poor lion.
Yes.
Oh my
but
God.
I mean, they're wonderful, wonderful, incredible stories that are hard to imagine today. Eddie having a fire extinguisher fight with another employee and running around the bar, you know, shooting each other with a fire extinguisher, riding a motorcycle around the interior of the bar.
The drugs were hot back then.
There were lots of drugs.
Real poppers, not the fake poppers we have.
Pharmaceutical poppers.
Really quickly, what's the difference between what people call poppers today versus what people were using as poppers back then? It was just a different chemical.
What was amyl nitrate back in the time?
It might have been. Was it pure? Has it been diluted today?
They don't use amyl nitrate now at all, because I believe that that's illegal. They use something else, and I think it has some of the similar effects, but people, the old timers,
you've heard that, huh?
I've heard it, like, it's much different. But I was kind of, you know, interested in something else that you wrote about, is that they would take their bandanas, and they would have a knotted end on the bandana, because, you know, we use bandanas for the hanky code. And I wonder if this goes hand in hand, and why they used hanky, because they would dip it in something called ethyl chloride,
yes,
and then put the knot between
their teeth and dance
around.
And, yes. And I guess the fumes from the ethyl chloride would get them
off. I think it was both the fumes and the ingestion of it. I mean, I think that's why you would do both. But it was mostly holding it in your teeth.
And
so
it's some
I think
kind of painkiller or something like that. It gives you the sense of being drunk. And I wonder why that it fell out of fashion, right? Like, you don't see people doing that anymore.
I have no idea.
But I had no idea that was a thing. And
you can still buy it on the internet. Mm-hmm. You could buy it for $39 on medpluspro.com.
See, it was cheaper. It was cheaper. I think in those days, I mentioned it being $10 to $15 a bottle. Yeah. So
that would have cheaper. That would have been expensive back then.
But yeah. I don't know how big the bottles were, how long it lasted.
And it was poppers versus snappers. And then snappers was the pharmaceutical poppers. Because I'd never even heard of snappers.
And that's what they give people, like, if they pass out and stuff. I remember as a kid just, you know, running across an empty assortment of... I guess the poppers also came in a glass vial.
That was broken, yeah.
That was snapped open,
yeah.
And you huffed on it. And I saw just a bunch of them on the floor. And I was like, oh, candy! And my mother's like, don't touch those! Those are what people use to get high at sex parties!
What?
And I was like 12 years old. And I was like, okay, can I still have some candy? So this, I can imagine that this nightclub scene was... You know, it was so new and it was so exciting, but the mainstream media, like newspapers and television stations and radio stations, largely, did they ignore it?
No, actually, one of the unique things about the Bearded Lady is it's surprising how often the Bearded Lady is mentioned in gossip columns in the Sun-Times, the Tribune, the Chicago Daily News. Announced on radio, like when the Bearded Lady would show up at the Chicago Film Festival, Claudia Cassidy says, and the Bearded Lady is here. And the Bearded Lady became a social celebrity in Chicago that just, had never really been anyone like that, to my knowledge, in the media prior to that.
Mm-hmm. So this was, the Bearded Lady was a creation of I don't know how to describe it, a performance artist, right? Robert Tice.
Yes.
Who, he was a Chicago native?
No, he was from a suburb of Buffalo.
And what inspired Robert to want to create this larger-than-life character?
He had been in the Vietnam War in Korea, and after he was, after he got out of the service, he went to San Francisco and had seen the Coquettes, and was especially motivated by Hibiscus, who had a beard and wore a feminine dress. BL took that idea and sort of went further with the whole flipping the gender of the Bearded Lady thing from the circus days, and then created an act where he would have... I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. Have layer after layer after layer of clothing on, and would slowly disrobe to wearing a woman's one-piece bathing suit, usually.
So it was a little bit of a striptease burlesque element.
It was a little bit of striptease, but it was when you would hear the opening chords to Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra Love's Theme, the crowd at the bistro would sort of part. And it would grow very silent. The music would stop except for that. And the Bearded Lady would come out and oftentimes would have his back to the audience, which he called giving back to the community, by the way, which I love. So he would slowly turn around, and then the next song that it would segue into was Who's That Lady by the Isley Brothers. He would be holding usually a large hand fan, and as they got into the chorus of Who's That Lady, he'd lower the fan and sort of look over the crowd. And then he would start taking off the layers of clothes. So he might be wearing a house dress and underneath it another house dress, and then a peasant blouse and gauchos, and then maybe another house dress, and then a bustier, and then, you know, it literally, people were absolutely amazed at the amount of clothing that BL was able to get onto his body.
I love that you call him BL.
Everyone,
bearded lady.
But almost everyone I interviewed who knew BL personally, the bearded lady mm-hmm. personally, would refer to him as BL. And also, BL would go by either male or female pronoun. Mm. BL just was that excited about being recognized that literally would go by he or she.
Now, did you know the bearded lady?
I have the feeling I met the bearded lady in the 80s, but I really don't have, I didn't meet the bearded lady as the bearded lady. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, but I have like a vague at a bar memory. But
because after
really.
Living in Tokyo for a while, she came back to Chicago, and I remember people like, the bearded lady is here. And you're like, ooh, you know, because yeah. we didn't really have a lot of access to LGBT history.
Sure. Well, and by that point, I mean, by the 80s, AIDS started to hit, and it just, the atmosphere had changed completely, and it wasn't the issue anymore, and there was almost like a disappearing of that history. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I really wanted to do with this book, was sort of show especially young people that history is fun. I mean, mm-hmm. there were a lot of people doing a lot of outrageous things before today, mm-hmm. you know, that it wasn't all like Stonewall protests, AIDS, and then today, mm-hmm. that there was a lot of other things going on. And I think by entertaining them and making them excited about it, that's how you engage young people with history. But so that's been a big goal.
It was a challenge for you, though, doing this book, though, because you mentioned that, you know, a lot of the people who were involved in the nightlife scene died from AIDS.
Yes.
Or, you know, there's a yes. lot of chemical dependency, and a lot yes. of people fell victim to that.
Plus, I'm talking about the 70s with the nightclub scene. So the people were a lot of times on drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so my questions would be, you remember when you were at the bistro 45 years ago and you were wasted that night? And so a lot of the difficulties were sort of right there. But mm-hmm. enough came together where it could be pieced together. And I really, my biggest goal was just to do this community justice and mm-hmm. to do BL mm-hmm. justice and hopefully capture some of that craziness.
What attracted you to BL in the first place?
When I was working on the Chuck Brenslow book with Tracy Baim. Leatherman, the legend of mm-hmm. Chuck Brenslow. Chuck was, at the time, Chuck owned the Gold Coast. Chuck was the man who began International Mr. Leather. Mm-hmm. Chuck had Man's Country. Chuck was one of the two founders of the Leather Archives. He's sort of the like a kingpin of the Chicago LGBT community, mm-hmm. and especially the leather community.
And before he did that, he was a pioneer in physique photography.
Yes, Chris mm-hmm. Studios. Chris yeah. Studios. So
he got all those beefcake punks that we still masturbate to all these years later. He was one of the first ones to turn to the ballet.
Oh, yeah.
He was photographing the ballet, and then later on he did athletes and stuff.
Well, his partner, Dom, was a choreographer and a dancer himself, so he had a lot of connection there. Dom is also Etienne, the
visual
artist.
The artist was also
Etienne.
Mentor to Tom McFinlin.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Tom
or
Finland,
a contemporary.
They were contemporaries.
Yeah.
I think they refer to him as a mentor.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
The ones at Chicago do. Yeah.
But yeah. So anyway, I was working on the Chuck Brenslow book, and we were talking about the River North area because the most popular place, where the Gold Coast moved a few times, but its most popular location was at 501 North Clark. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about River North, and people were, you know, discussing the area at the time, and someone said, you know, the bistro, I remembered the bearded lady, and then in my mind I picture it as the bearded lady, comma, the bearded lady was someone who I could never imagine what they did in their day-to-day life. So immediately, as soon as they said that, I thought,
Well, it's interesting then that, he asked Oprah asked these other kids, what do you do when you're not doing this?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing that makes BL, mm-hmm. Such a fascinating character is that he eventually becomes an art historian, an art collector, and an artist himself. So you have somebody who not only was a performance artist and a piece of art themselves, mm-hmm. but someone who has experienced art in an unusual way in all these different formats. I found the whole story really fascinating. And not only BL, this nightclub scene is populated with so many memorable people. And I really fell in love with the place, and I fell in love with a lot of the people working on it, you know, and that was my main goal, is just to try to convey how fun I thought this was. So
The term performance art is a term that's always loosely thrown around, and even like Lady Gaga calls herself a performance artist. But it was actually a real and still is a very real form, a real genre of art where people categorize things and events and experiences and themselves when it doesn't fit into anything else. It doesn't fit into theater, it doesn't fit into sculpture, or it may have elements of all those things, but it transcends them at the same time.
I think BL at the time, but this would have been more referred to as a specialty dancer. And again, he didn't dance so much as he'd step forward, step back, step to the side, step to the other side. But the whole thing that was going on was with the taking off of the layers of clothes, which was always met with this incredibly loud screaming from the audience. And then BL would scream back at the audience, and then he'd take something else off and they'd scream louder, and then he'd scream louder. And it's interesting. He's one of the few people I can think of at a nightclub where they actually had to put the music back on to quiet the crowd. So, I mean, he would rile people up
with the audience, and for a lot of nightclub acts at the time, they weren't as interactive.
No, and the thing that made it charming too is BL was celebrated for like all the things that we would look at as sort of things that weren't perfect. Like he wouldn't always know the third song he would perform mm-hmm. to. He would maybe not know the lyrics to, and he wasn't a great dancer, but he was so in the moment and so clearly having fun that people just embraced BL and loved him. And when I talk about the layers of clothing too, I should mention that everything BL wore had to have snaps or Velcro. Or in other words, it could never be taken over his head, because he was also wearing usually some sort of crazy headpiece or headdress. Like one of my favorites is he had a rotary phone hooked up onto a wire on his head with the receiver end floating into space to the side. And coming out of the receiver was a bubble that just said, "Hello." They were very elaborate sparklers, candelabra, baby toys, and he would also hide everything in his beard and his hair. So he was literally have like props all over the place.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Eddie, the guy who made a home.
Yes, Eddie Dugan,
the bistro for the Bearded Lady. What was Eddie like?
Eddie was my interpretation of Eddie is that he was loved to party. Eddie was like the party guy. He knew how to throw a party, and better than that, he knew how to make people have a good time. Someone describes in the book meeting Eddie, and they'd say Eddie would come up to you, and within 2 minutes, he would make you feel like you were the reason he was happy, that you were the reason he was happy that he came to the bar that night, that you were the reason that he opened the bistro. And then he would move to the next person and convince them of exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. He was just very much...
You are the person, you are the reason why we do this podcast. But you, only you.
There's a real power in that, though. It's an amazing people skill to be able to make people feel kind of a genuine connection, and sure. He had that, and he also had the ability to turn everything into a party, and that's what he wanted to do, was to make his bar be a party every single night.
This was certainly like it sounds like such a whoop-de-doo and a wonderful time, but these were people who were hurting, these were people who were struggling in one way or another, and they turned to this nightclub scene as a form of therapy, as a way to escape.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I think a lot of people, there's stories in the book about people who would, you know, wear regular clothes maybe from home and get changed into the bath in the bathroom, maybe, you know, maybe drag, maybe something else, but that they would could be themselves a lot of times there. They could let loose. They, a lot of people, you know, were still closeted during that era. They could go to the bistro and know that they were accepted, not because they were different, but that their differentness was celebrated. And that was, that's so important.
I think that's why performance art and this kind of transgressive art was so vital to queer communities.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, you always hear the term, Mark, what is the cliche we hear? Performer breaks down the boundaries between performer and audience.
Yeah, something like that.
Art that breaks down boundaries between performer and audience. And when we think about those boundaries, we think of them in a formal way, like you're the audience sitting in a chair and watching a play or a movie. And in some ways, as an audience member, you don't have access to speak, to be heard, to have your story to be told. And because all this transgressive art was happening at the time in these clubs, it gave disenfranchised people an ability to be heard, to have their story told.
I think so. And I think part of it was because BL was having such a good time, and because he was overweight, and because he, you know, he would be wearing layers of clothes in a hot nightclub, and he was overweight, he would be sweating a lot of times pretty profusely. I think he was celebrated for being who he was, and that conveyed to the audience. People were like, oh, okay, you know, this is all about someone who's just being basically like cheered beyond belief for being themselves. And that's very, very affirming.
Did the bearded lady, like many drag queens, grow to hate being the bearded lady?
Hate their own version of their own drag, not just the bearded lady.
Did she
hate her own persona?
I don't think so. I think after going to Tokyo, I think that's a way to sort of remove maybe yourself from it, to go to a completely different continent where you're not known. I think the Oprah episode we talked about earlier shows a little bit of that. I don't think BL hated it as much as BL felt eventually removed from it. Like, I think Tokyo provided sort of a time out where he could maybe appreciate the persona for what BL was, but at the same time, realized that he was a lot more than that.
How many shows at just the bistro did the bearded lady do?
It was, I believe, Thursday through Sunday, two shows a night, midnight and 2 a.m., and then sometimes a show at 10 on special occasions. He performed with stars. He performed in front of stars, which never intimidated BL because he considered himself one. He performed for 9 years. From open to close, 82 to...
So that's like 500 shows a year.
He had some disagreements with Eddie periodically, so there was a period where he was not at the bistro, but he would perform at other places around town. So he was still performing as BL, but just not always at the bistro.
And so I'm reading here in a biography, Bearded Lady later moved on to a club called Coconuts.
Coconuts was also owned by Eddie. That, and in its first, it was right at sort of just north of Foster and Sheridan. And then BL went to Tokyo. This is while the bistro is still open. And then Coconuts closed in that location eventually and then reopened almost the same address, but on Broadway. So a lot of times that gets confusing because they're both called Coconuts. They're the same owners. They just
different locations.
BL, bearded lady, she was a sensation for her day. She not only was known in Chicago, but she performed all over the Midwest.
Yes.
In Paris, Tokyo, Bangkok. She was the height of American nightclub culture. But when we talk about that, it's usually reserved for the Coquettes or the club kids in the 80s in New York. Why do we not know as much about, until now, with your book,
thank you,
about the bearded lady as we should, since she was obviously such a huge name for her day?
I think part of it is sort of this thing in LGBTQ culture we see a lot, where it's like everything happens in New York, or it happens in San Francisco, and if it doesn't happen in one of those two, it happens in LA. And Chicago is just kind of not seen as having a vital history. And that's been one of the things I really want to do as a historian, too. I consider myself
child.
Well, I consider myself a grassroots historian, because I want to sort of put Chicago on the map as saying, like, we weren't just this flyover city where everybody was pining to go somewhere else. I mean, there was a vibrant culture here.
Chicago is a mecca.
Yeah, a mecca
for the world.
Sure.
People from all over the world definitely come here to start a new life, or just, you know, even if it's just a stopover.
And I think part of that, too, with the way things are remembered, is a lot of the big media outlets at the time were New York and L.A. And San Francisco for papers. And I for publishing as well. I just think that Chicago hasn't been given its due.
Well, I think also it's interesting, as you pointed out when I saw you speak, is that, you know, this club was, the Bistro was open, what was it, 5 years?
4 years. Four years before Studio 54.
Right, which is like when everybody thinks about like a gay disco, they're all like Studio 54, but other places were happening.
Other places were happening, but the thing that I find fascinating too is the Bistro sort of pioneered a lot of the things we associate with disco culture. I mean, the Bistro was doing this since 1973, you know, and it just, the whole dance atmosphere was completely different. And they pioneered so many different effects, different lighting techniques that that were sort of duplicated and thought of as disco norm.
So Chicago brought some disco to the scene. They brought house music. What's next?
We bring all the fun stuff.
And I think, you know, this is a story of urban queer life in urban environments.
Yes.
You know, I'm so heartbroken that the Get Down on Netflix was canceled, because it was such a great TV series that showed how hip hop and disco culture fused together and interwove in that same time period. And Mark, you were saying that like a lot of queer culture and queer spaces were very multicultural by nature, even though there was a lot of racism.
Well, you see, I mean, if you still, like, if you travel the world, when you go to a gay bar in, like, an international city, it's going to be filled with international people. Like, when I was in Oslo, the gay bars were filled with people from all over the world, and we're one of the communities where you can't not mix with other people.
You
know, when you go to Boys Town or to a thing, it's like you're going to be there with black people, with Hispanic people, with all different kinds of people, because you know, we're gay people and we have to come together, whereas like white people can kind of segregate themselves more.
And I think, you know, in terms of music, you know, when you start talking about the history of house music or the history of hip hop or disco or rap, a lot of that stuff is about cultures intermingling and collaborating and speaking to each other.
Well, and I just think so much of it was all about liberation. I think people were so excited to just be open and to be themselves that it filled them with such a sense of abandon that I think I'm so enthused to talk about how people came together and how this is how communities was made. Communities made at the bars. It was made at the bathhouses. It was made in different places. It wasn't always made in meeting rooms. I mean, this is how people got to know each other. Someone once told me this story when I was working on this book. They talked about what it was like in that period. And they said, you could go out on a Friday night with $20, which would include being out for the whole night and cab fare. You would go out and you could, you know, come home with money in your pocket, and you would have made 20 new friends, and you would see those 20 new friends out again the next night. That was the other thing, is people didn't go out. People went out every night. A lot of these people, you know, they weren't like, it wasn't a weekend thing. It was every night.
You know, I remember when I was younger, it was just a different atmosphere, and you would go out because, you know, the exuberance of youth, I think, is part of it too. But it's like, you know, there'd be nothing on TV. You're like, oh, let's get out. I have to meet somebody. I have to see somebody. I mean, it used to cost you 5 cents to call someone from your own phone.
But let's be clear here. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics,
mm-hmm.
Consumer Price Index, mm-hmm. $20 in 1975 was worth $95 today.
Oh, wow.
So it's a lot of money to spend on a week. I can't spend that kind of money.
Yeah, but the other thing, two people had more disposable income, right?
Yeah, that's also the...
Yeah, keep going. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. That's also at a time, too, when rents were a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. These are mostly people, too, that didn't have a lot of people to support other than their own mm-hmm. good time.
Yeah.
So...
the good time
choice. Yeah. Now, when I was I think a lot of people drank for free, mm-hmm. too. So, I mean, I think you could go out there, but if you meet a lot of people... You know, and I think
you know the bartenders,
and you know the bartenders.
So, are you guys
know.
Saying that maybe there's more consolidation of wealth, which translates to more inequality, but it's more expensive to have even a fraction of that lifestyle today for people?
Oh, I don't think there are that many people I know that could afford to go out.
On a Friday.
Every night. And a lot of the people I talked to were doing like, oh, yeah, I worked at, you know, I worked as a secretary or I worked at Marshall Fields. I mean, I don't think today if you found someone who worked, you know, retail or worked in an office that they could afford to go out every night. But these people did.
And they owned homes. And had two kids and had a car.
But I found fascinating, too, reading your book, is at the time where all these gay discos were happening, there was a lot of literally disco infernos. Like you mentioned, like 5 or 6 gay clubs that went up in smoke.
Yes. One of the things that eventually that Eddie grew terrified of was they had a fire with someone just... I think someone threw a cigarette, like emptied an ashtray in a garbage that just... Mm-hmm. wasn't out and mm-hmm. it caused some smoke damage, but nothing that just some simple repainting couldn't do. But at the time, yeah, fires were very big in a lot of the gay clubs.
Now, you don't think that necessarily they were arson, you know, or they were targeted as a hate crime or what? Because, I mean, in 1973, there was that, you know, that case in New Orleans where how many gay men died? And that bar was like 30
The
or
upstairs
40.
Lounge disaster was horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. There's a great book, by the way, about that called Tinderbox that just came out. That's wonderful.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of different reasons for it. I think, too, a lot of people smoked at the time. I don't know technically how much smoke detectors were.
I don't even, were they? I don't remember them being a thing when I was a kid.
I have the feeling that there were a lot of fires that weren't necessarily for any other cause than just we knew less.
Okay. All right.
And tell us about why sort of her height of popularity, she fell in love, Robert, the bearded lady, with a guy named Jeff Bruce.
Yes.
And then say, you know, fuck all this shit. Let's go to Japan.
It was the year that the bistro was closing.
Okay.
Jeff came to town. They hit it off really well. And Jeff was going to move to Tokyo and be out.
Jeff was involved in
he was a teacher.
It was a English, teacher.
Yes. And what happened was, I think everything was timing. The bistro was closing. BL was working at Coconuts as well and didn't like Coconuts as much. And BL had always wanted to return to Asia since being in Korea. Since being stationed in
Korea. Because he was a veteran, so he had some really fond memories of this, despite being a war. Being stationed in Korea.
BL had a very deep appreciation of Eastern lifestyles in general. He loved how much history personal history was. I'm trying to think of the word.
Appreciated.
Sure. Thank you. He liked the art a lot. He liked the fact of just the culture and the people. He always had been enamored of that. And so when he moved to Tokyo, he really fell in love with the city as well.
It's interesting right now, a lot of our famous drag queen friends are all vacationing in Thailand. Oh. Perfidia, Misunderstood, and they posted on social media like photos of themselves with their friends, and there's like 20 people right there. You know, a lot of New York City nightclub personalities all hanging out in Thailand.
It's cheap and you can get great costumes there.
And I think that's part of it is like, you know, when we think about the mindset of a transgressive, gender-bending performance art, queer performance artist, there's elements of Asian culture, and there's also, they tend to be pack rats. They tend to be people who love to collect things and ideas and nuances and music and costumes. And certainly Bearded Lady must have had an insane amount. You're actually wearing her scarf right now.
I'm wearing one of BL's scarves right now. BL would, originally the bistro was a restaurant, and in the basement there were sort of lockers and things for restaurant staff to change, and BL kept garbage bags full of clothes and props down there. Mm. And then that said nothing of where BL's apartment. At first it was a studio on Breyer. And that place was just completely overrun. People talk about, you know, making footpaths through the boxes, like that kind of thing. Then moved to 4408 North Dover, where, you know, the place was described as a forest of clothing racks. And just a deep appreciation of all this stuff, and literally used a lot of the stuff. But also one of BL's favorite things to do was shop. Mm. BL loved to shop.
She was a hoarder.
She, and,
like most drag queens.
And, and loved the whole process. Loved Maxwell Street, which I don't know, is that before you guys' time?
Is that in Chicago?
It was still happening a little bit when we got here, which is like Maxwell Street was a flea market on the street.
Basically a flea market, mm-hmm. Sunday mornings, yes. Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
On Maxwell Street.
Southwest Loop.
Mm-hmm. And you get a Maxwell Street Polish is kind of like a, mm-hmm. you know, famous.
So it was kind of an outdoor.
Yes, an outdoor bazaar. Mm-hmm. And BL loved it because BL also loved to negotiate price. And BL could find a lot of things there, like a lot of different fashion styles from different cultures, a lot of weird props. A lot of things that weren't just something you'd find going into a store, you know, and you can do that somewhat at resale shops, and which BL also loved, but not to the extent that you could do it at Maxwell Street, where it was just, you know, vendor after vendor after vendor, dozens and dozens.
Who are the kind of successors to the Bearded Lady today? That you would, who would you?
I'm old now. I don't know yet.
I would say like someone like JoJo is definitely, you know, the person who I would say is very much like a pack rat, very enamored with Asian culture. You know, JoJo's performances and a lot of these club kids' performances tend to be very transgressive in that sense. But, you know, when reading about this in the book, and we should probably read a little bit about.
Okay,
about
sure.
It,
and you actually are going to donate a book for our fundraiser.
Yes.
So
I would love for you guys to have a copy of the book.
So somebody who makes a donation to our GoFundMe, and you can do that at GoFundMe.com/feastoffuncomputer, will draw a name from the list of people.
Good luck.
Thank you. So donate now if you want to get the book.
Do you want? Okay. I'm not sure how much of this I've touched on earlier, but this is basically just a small introduction to the Bearded Lady. And all the chapters in the book are different songs, that disco songs that were popular at the time. This chapter is called Dancing Queen. The Bearded Lady, a.k.a. BL, was heavyset with a mane of brown hair that hung halfway to his ass. His full beard frequently sparkled with glitter, and his manicured nails were long. He tended to refrain from polish, but sometimes painted them dark red, purple, or black. The pinky nail on his right hand was especially long, which often meant scoop and sniff in the disco era. His makeup was theatrically gauche. Some described his makeup kit as his box of crayons. BL was fond of kimonos and sunglasses, jewelry, 5-inch heels, parasols, and opera gloves, but his signature props were the hand fans that he used with coy abandon, both on and off the stage. At the Bistro, BL appeared Thursday through Sunday at midnight and 2 a.m. for two 15-minute shows. On special occasions, he did a third show at 10 p.m. Technically, he was a theatrical dancer, though he didn't dance so much as hop and move and turn. Forward, side, back, turn, forward. His appeal didn't lie in his dancing skills, but in his dancing attire. BL was layered with clothes. As he moved, he went through a kind of metamorphosis, shedding layers and transforming before the audience's eyes. The effect was spellbinding. BL's drag was never about glamour, but always about the reveal and the surprise. His performance, his act of transformation, was an apt metaphor for the newly liberated gay community and the nightlife scene at the time. His persona, both on stage and off, was one of unbridled joy, silliness, and being fabulous, not in spite of his imperfections, but because of them. BL was about possibilities and becoming. He was thrilled to be having such a glorious time, and his mood was infectious. The crowds adored him. Despite his celebrity, BL remained a mystery. The offstage life of this euphoric creature seemed unfathomable to many, until now.
Dun, dun, dun. So in terms of, like, you know, I'm sorry, earlier I was wanting to talk about how Chicago nightclub acts tend to be a little bit more separated from the audience comparing to what the Bearded Lady was trying to do in terms of getting the audience to become part of the act.
Oh, BL a lot of times would grab, if she saw a guy who she liked in the audience, she frequently would grab him out of the audience to come dance with her for the third number.
What did people like Sylvester or the Cockettes or Divine?
Sylvester was at the Bistro a few times. Sylvester actually had a crush on the DJ.
Oh. But
Lou,
I mean,
DeVito.
What was their thoughts on the Bearded Lady? Was there a lot of camaraderie, or was there a little jealousy, or
Between acts, you mean?
Between these artists and
with the performers, like the recording stars and BL, there wasn't usually a rivalry. There were also other performers at the Bistro, and you know, if you have a roster of say five different people who are performing periodically at a, you know, there's going to be rivalries. There wasn't a lot of animosity.
They didn't have Facebook to post like
shady updates.
There was some sort of competitiveness, but it wasn't anything that was really that earth shattering.
How did they resolve their conflicts?
A lot of times, actually, they were not always meant to be resolved. Oh. A lot of times, the added drama sort of heightened things.
So it was part of the experience to have the soap opera unfolding. Whereas today, I would say, like, a lot of people who get wrapped up in that type of nightclub conflict, they usually wind up leaving that scenario. They remove themselves out of that toxic environment. But in this case, it may have been played up to create. Word of mouth.
And I was going to say, I don't think it was necessarily toxic. It was more like, it was never anything that sort of noxious. It was more just the way things were. But exactly, getting the bar talked about was always huge. So anything that people would talk about, if they'd say, did you hear about the rivalry between so-and-so and so-and-so, he's not going to dismiss that because that got people talking about the Bistro.
What can young drag queens and club kids and gay artists, queer artists learn about the Bearded Lady?
I think the most inspirational thing that I read about the Bearded Lady, or that is in the book, is about just loving yourself and what you're doing despite your imperfections. BL wasn't coming out there saying, I'm the best dancer, I'm the best entertainer. He just always looked like he was having the best time. And that was really infectious. People love seeing other people having a good time.
Drag is built on transcending failure.
Okay.
You know, that's what I always say. I tell this all the time, and it's fascinating to see these themes popping up and up and again and again throughout history. That, you know, it's almost like as human beings, we have to have this type of art from time to time in order to empower ourselves.
Sure.
And it's part of it is looking at failure as something desirable, as something to enjoy, something to relish and not be scared of it.
Well, I think part of it too was that BL went out there with his imperfections and everything else and was absolutely thrilled to be doing it, wasn't worried about judgments. And the beautiful thing about LGBTQ culture at the time was that it wasn't judgmental. People loved him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was loved because of that. And I think there's so many people worry about what other people are going to think. Here's someone who had like plenty of things if someone were to, you know, nitpick about different things that they could say, but he sort of embraced them all and gave them back to the audience, and the audience loved it.
Owen Keenan's Dugan's Bistro and The Legend of the Bearded Lady is now available for sale wherever fine books are sold, and you can get a copy.
Yes, we have it. It's currently on the shelves at Quimby's, Women and Children First, and Unabridged Bookstore, as well as online.
For people online, they can buy it on Amazon and the links on our website, feastoffun.com. Mm-hmm. And we're giving a book away.
Yes, we're going to give a book away. So if you've donated to the GoFundMe or you plan on doing it before we reach our goal of $3,500, right now we're at $2,795. So we only have $705 left to reach.
I think someone would pay $705 for a copy of this book.
Yeah, if somebody actually donates $705, getting the book.
I'll personalize it.
I am so blessed and happy to be able to tell this story again. You know, so the bearded lady is somebody who throughout my life is her name keeps popping up like you know, the memes in what is it, Doctor Who? You know, Mark and I were sort of like characters in Doctor Who, are traveling around and discovering stories, hoping to make things better. And the bearded lady's name just keeps popping up and up and up again. And to me, is the bearded lady is somebody that we can learn a lot from in how to celebrate your life, how to make the most with what you got, and how to find love and you know, find peace and happiness in despite being the middle child of society.
I think a lot of it too that's really affirming for me about the bearded lady's story is the recurring is the theme of reinvention is huge. That's the thing, is BL was constantly looking, I think, for ways to sort of, he was very much like his act, as I just picture it, as, you know, shedding layer after layer after layer, you know, where you're sort of become something that maybe you weren't always, but it's sort of is somewhat similar to what you were. Mm-hmm. It's just a very interesting story of someone evolving into themselves, but sort of keeping what they were at the same time. And I think a big part of this book too is that BL is sort of, I use him as the vehicle to tell this story, but the bistro in and of itself and the characters involved in that galaxy are just fascinating. I mean, this book could have easily been written about any of them as well.
And then in her final years, she shed off all her costumes or clothes and dissolved.
Cut her hair.
Dissolved into the ether. No, actually, she was known by Japanese school children as Santa Claus.
Yes. Santa-san.
Santa-san.
Well,
that
BL
is such
stopped,
a beautiful ending.
BL stopped dyeing his hair.
Yeah.
So it went white. Mm. And it was, he actually looks kind of a lot like, very much like, especially a Western version of Santa Claus.
Wow.
And was hugely popular. I mean, can you imagine having BL as your teacher in, if you're in a class for learning English as a second language? He, you know, there's stories about him pantomiming and doing this and doing that. And just it, class itself was a performance. So sure. Once he realized that teaching is just a sort of kind of a different sort of performance, except, you know, the kids
except
are sober.
The kids are sober. They're not high. And getting blowjobs in the bathroom.
But, once he sort of realized that, he became fantastic at it. I mean, it was always that sort of gift for being able to convey a magic to the crowd and an excitement about what he was doing.
And unfortunately, he's no longer with us.
No.
Yeah. He died in 2003?
He died of a blood cancer.
Wow.
He dissolved and said, I'm going back to my home planet.
And
thanks for all the laughs. Bye-bye.
And it's, you know, and it's kind of, it's sweet because BL always wanted to live to be 100. And he died, unfortunately, when he was 56. Part of his ashes were scattered in China. Because he would go to China a lot of times on trips to buy art. And part of his ashes actually are in Graceland Cemetery in the Columbarium Wall.
Here in Chicago?
Here in Chicago. You can see him at Graceland Cemetery, yes.
Oh, wow.
You can pay homage.
Owen, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having
me.
This has been fun. I get so excited when I'm talking about the bearded lady that I feel like I don't have a narrative. I just, if you could see how much I'm gesticulating, audiences, yeah, you'd be.
You are. You're beaming.
I'm beaming.
Well, she's quite the character, and I'm glad that you are giving like a whole new audience to her because she certainly deserves
it. I'm thrilled to be able to tell it.
I would love to. I wonder, is there any video footage of her performing?
There's not video footage. There is on YouTube. There's a video of BL I think it's the 76 or 77 Pride Parade.
Okay.
And she's carrying a Fiorucci bag and is wearing like kind of an Empire skirt with white hose.
I'll look for it.
Yeah, it's very, very, and basically she's just getting into place on the float. But
okay,
it's quite a production.
All right.
Would you say your experience was a feast of fun?
I'd say it was a huge feast of fun. And not only that, I would say that the lucky listener who gets this book is that feast of fun just keeps giving, you know?
Aww. I think you have a movie in the works here. This is
I
definitely
would love
sell this,
this.
Turn it into a motion picture.
It's and trust me, you could not write characters like the characters that are in this book. I've focused on Bearded Lady, but I've said it before. Eddie, T.J. Noble, who did a lot of the decor, or T.L. Noble, I'm sorry, T.L. Noble. Lou DeVito, the DJ, Planet Janet, the waitress. There's so many characters in this book that just, I would have given anything to go, if speaking of time travel, I would love to go back there for just one night.
Just for
just
the tribes.
One night.
One night only. One night only. And I want to thank the listeners for making this show possible. It is not, this show does not exist. This Feast of Fun is not here without your help. We thank you so much for listening to the show and sharing the program with your friends and telling people that you love about something that is so important to your everyday life, which is Feast of Fun. You take it granted. You think it's clean water coming out of the pipe. But in fact, you have to take care of it. You have to make sure that your community is healthy. And you do that by helping to contribute to Feast of Fun financially or by commenting and sharing the show with your friends.
It takes nurture.
And one of the best ways to support the show is to become a Plus member, and you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus. We also have t-shirts for sale at our store, feastoffun.com/store.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Owen. So much.
And wherever you are, bearded lady, Merry Christmas. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.